From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the unregulated world of Adver Games, online entertainment for children usually used to promote products. Also, a new compilation double CD of 32 varied musicians, many of whom live in Modesto or have ties to the area, and the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus celebrating its 25th anniversary. But first, remember H1N1, the strain of flu virus that was declared a pandemic? A lot of vaccine was made, and then H1N1 receded. What's going to happen to all the vaccine that was not used? And did health officials worldwide overreact to the new strain of H1N1 virus? Joining us are two local public health officers, Dr. Glenna Trochet from Sacramento County and Dr. Joseph Iser of Yolo County. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Well, I've seen ads in newspapers and even on an electronic billboard just across the road from our studio saying it's not too late to get your vaccination for H1N1. I don't recall seeing flu virus commercials in the summertime. Is this unusual? Let's start with Dr. Glenna Trochet.
Yes, hi. It is unusual, but you may recall that in 2009, the H1N1 virus was at one of its peaks. We've had a couple of peaks with it in the spring and summer. This is an unusual virus. It's a virus that started after the normal seasonal flu, and we've had it with us for a year. And although it's not in the news as much as it used to be, and we certainly believe that the vaccine has made a big dent in the number of people who get ill with the virus, it is still circulating.
Dr. Joseph Iser, do you know of many people who are following the advice of these ads or PSAs, public service announcements, and getting an H1N1 shot this summer?
The answer is yes and no. We're now in what's called phase four of the response to the epidemic, and that's when we have done, both Dr. Trochet and I and the other health officers around the state, have really done our huge mass vaccination points of distribution. And now we're trying to reach out to those hard-to-reach populations. And Dr. Trochet's population and mine may be mildly different. I probably have more farm workers and migrant workers than Sacramento County does, but we both do have those hard-to-reach populations, the homeless, the foreign language speaking, and our clinics have been pretty well attended. What we have done, and I've seen Dr. Trochet's ads, is to target places where we know hard-to-reach populations will be showing up. We work with the local community to make sure that we will be accepted there, and we go out to provide the vaccine. We're getting towards the tail end of that. Probably by the end of this month, we will quit doing those. But we still have vaccine, and like Dr. Trochet, we'll still be giving it in our local immunization clinic here in Woodland.
Dr. Trochet, doesn't the flu virus mutate all the time? How long is this H1N1 vaccine good for?
Well, you're correct. The virus does mutate, and this particular virus has been watched more closely than any other virus that I can think of in my professional life. And so far, the vaccine remains effective against it. So although it is true that viruses do mutate as they reproduce, replicate, this one is still susceptible. And if you get vaccinated, you will be protected against this particular virus.
We're talking about H1N1 vaccine. You may have seen notices in newspapers and elsewhere saying it's not too late to get your H1N1 shot. My guests are two local public health officers, Dr. Glenna Trochet of Sacramento County and Dr. Joseph Iser of Yolo County. Dr. Iser, how much vaccine is there sitting around waiting to be used? Is there a lot?
I would say that there's a lot. During phase three, which was our really mass distribution efforts, we took over the distribution from the state, and we made sure that really all of our local providers and our healthcare systems, for us that's Sutter Davis and Woodland and Communicare, the community health centers, and the private doctors, and some other clinics. We have a Kaiser clinic in Davis. We made sure that they had more than enough vaccine when we had it so that they could service their populations and help us get the entire population. They still have plenty of vaccine, and they can order more from the state if they need to. We have plenty of vaccine on hand. I think you might have a question coming up with this, but the novel H1N1 vaccine will be incorporated into the seasonal influenza vaccine that will be available this fall. Part of that reason is that we absolutely do believe that not only will it continue to circulate during the summer, but that it may come back with another peak, although probably not as large, in the fall. I'm not sure whether Dr. Trochet would agree with me, so we can ask her that too.
Okay, Dr. Trochet.
Well, I would agree that it's likely to circulate. In previous pandemics, you know, the one that everybody talks about, the pandemic of 1917, was really the pandemic of 1916 through 1918, because they do last for a couple of years. So I would agree with Dr. Iser that it is very likely to be circulated again in the fall. Regarding the how much vaccine there is extra vaccine. Some of it doesn't expire till 2011. So what we are planning to do here in Sacramento, like Yolo County, we've been trying to target populations that may not have been vaccinated during our mass vaccination clinics, and trying to ensure that everyone who wants to be protected is able to be protected. But we will be keeping some of our vaccine that doesn't expire to 2011 in case there is an outbreak for an outbreak response, because the truth is, although the vaccine, the virus will be included in the seasonal influenza vaccine for next year, if we have an outbreak of H1N1, we may need to do some rapid vaccination.
Dr. Iser, do you think too much vaccine was made?
Boy, you know, that's a difficult question. The CDC orders vaccine as they think fit, related to the severity of the projections. And that's the word we need to underline, the projected risk. And I think when early on we all looked at this vaccine, that's health officers, the state health departments, the CDC, and others, we saw a much more significant risk than what ended up being. And by that, I mean the number of people and the severity of the illness. It looked to be far more severe early on, and that's when those decisions have to be made. I will not fault the CDC. I actually used to work for them. I won't fault them for trying to get as much vaccine available as quickly as possible. I think they did as good a job as they could, given the state of the technology.
There's been government and medical criticism of the World Health Organization, accusing it of overreacting to the H1N1 threat. Dr. Glenna Trochet, do you think that is fair criticism?
Let me put it this way. If it had been, if more people had died than have died, and we hadn't responded aggressively, there would have been criticism for not doing that, for not being aggressive enough. So, you know, in retrospect, people will say, oh, it wasn't a big deal. But in fact, we do know that children and young people have died from this disease. And in Sacramento County, we did have 5 people die at home before they were even able to get medical help. So this was a virus that was significantly different from seasonal flu. Most people who die from seasonal flu do not die without medical attention.
I see.
So it's really hard. I think we are going to have to review our response when all is said and done, take a look at the severity of the disease, and have lessons learned, and perhaps there was more. We were more aggressive than needed, but perhaps we were just right. It's hard to tell right now.
Yes.
I would also like to put a little bit of context to the question about excess vaccine. I really would like to sometime in my professional life be in a situation where there's more demand for the vaccine than there is vaccine. Every year, to my knowledge, even with seasonal flu, there is more vaccine produced than is used. And every year we have excess vaccine. However, not everybody who needs the vaccine gets vaccinated every year.
Dr. Iser, I don't know if you or Dr. Trochet saw a story in the Washington Post a few days ago, and there was criticism of the World Health Organization that I alluded to. Part of it was accusing them of being influenced by consultants who have financial ties to drug companies, and drug companies, of course, make vaccines. Are you familiar with that criticism, and do you think there's anything to it?
Generally, I am familiar with it. I didn't read this article, so I don't know about that. But we all use consultants, and particularly our own federal agencies and the WHO, because that provides a greater breadth of experience and expertise for us to draw on, and a better ability to advise us. So I wouldn't necessarily fault them, as long as they kept in mind that the consultants may or may not have a conflict of interest.
Just for the record, I'll read from the newspaper report. It says that there was a criticism of 2004 guidelines from the World Health Organization, developed based in part on the advice of three experts who received consulting fees from the two leading manufacturers of antiviral drugs used against the virus. But I don't know that necessarily a direct connection has been drawn between that influence and the recommendations by the World Health Organization. What do we expect this winter flu-wise? Is it too early to know, Dr. Trochet?
Yes, I think it is. I'm really good at telling you what happened in retrospect. I'm not very good at predicting the future. But we don't really know. You have already heard us say that it is expected that the H1N1 virus will be circulating this winter. And so we are all preparing, as always, for the worst and hoping for the best.
Dr. Iser, same perspective from you?
I would agree with Dr. Trochet. Normally what we do, and what we did actually last year at this time, is watch how the virus penetrates into the southern hemisphere during their influenza season. And what we saw was that the southern hemisphere started out with regular seasonal influenza, and very quickly the novel H1N1 virus took over, and actually at the end of the season was the predominant influenza. We started out with novel H1N1 as the predominant influenza, and that's really all we saw, virtually all we saw here in California throughout the entire seasonal influenza period of time. So looking into the future, there still are a lot of people who haven't been immunized or who haven't had the disease. So we could have another significant amount of novel H1N1 in our populations, or we can start to see the seasonal influenza viruses that we normally would see start to come back. And it's way too early to predict that. We might get a better idea as we watch the southern hemisphere over our summer, their winter.
Yes. That's Dr. Joseph Iser, Yolo County's public health officer, also with us. Dr. Glenna Trochet, Sacramento County's public health officer. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Advergames, online entertainment used to promote products like fast food to children. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more about the people and topics in our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Today on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, food allergies and how to diagnose and treat them, plus a look at multitasking. Can our brains evolve to make sense of all the information flowing into and around us? And why your brain may get better with age. That's Science Friday after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Companies that sell to children are making heavy use of something called Advergames. It's online entertainment. Kids are often directed to the games through commercials and TV. UC Davis researchers recently studied what messages Advergames send about food and health. They join us. We'll start with Diana Cassidy, Associate Professor of Public Health Sciences at UC Davis. Diana, welcome.
Thank you.
What brought you and your colleague to study Advergames? What drew you to them?
Well, we started with a real concern about childhood obesity, which probably you and all of your listeners know. It's one of the most important health crises that we face today. And we started with an obvious target, which was a study on advertising on children's television, and found that it was prevalent. And then Jennifer Culp, my co-author on this study, took a closer look at the television ads and found that a subset of them were advertising for websites. And so we became curious to see what those websites had.
Well, Jennifer Culp, who is training coordinator with the Food Stamp Nutrition Education Program at UC Davis and also an author of the AdverGame study. Jennifer, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Well, what did you find when you took a closer look at AdverGames?
Well, basically what we found is we, based on the television commercial ads, we found, we did a further investigation of 19 internet sites. And when we coded those 19 internet sites, we found that there were a total of 247 AdverGames across the different internet sites. And branding, and in every single game, there was some kind of brand identifier, whether it be a logo, a product package, or a food product.
Why do we use the word AdverGames? Is this a word that the industry uses? Is it a word that the people who use the games use? Or is it just a word that researchers use when describing it? Diana Cassidy?
Well, it's commonly used in the research field, but I think it's a descriptive term. It tells us that it's a game, and so naturally appealing to children. But it's not just a game. It's not as innocent as that. It's an advertisement through and through.
What kind of products, Jennifer Culp, are we typically seeing promoted and advertised in AdverGames?
Candy, sweetened cereals, convenience foods, and snack foods, like chips.
So not the healthiest food options?
No, not what we would consider the healthiest food options.
Well, why are these companies, why are they buying time on TV to promote the AdverGames? Why not just promote their product on TV? Or is there some advantage that the AdverGames give them that they can't get from TV?
Well, that's a great question, and we can't say for sure what the link is between the AdverGame and the influence on children. But what we do know is that the AdverGames are very interactive, unlike a television advertisement, which is passive. You're just sitting there watching. These games are very interactive. They're fun. They give children a positive feeling, and it keeps them engaged for a long time period so that they could potentially be looking at this brand identifiers for, you know, up to 30 minutes. There's some very limited evidence to show that there was one study done in which they used an AdverGame specifically for what we would consider an unhealthy food product versus fruit and vegetables. And there was some evidence to show that children, when they played the AdverGame with the unhealthy food, that they preferred that. And we do know from the work that's been done with television advertisements that children will prefer and request foods that they've seen advertised on TV.
Can you give us a concrete idea of what one might find in one of these AdverGames that's promoting unhealthy food, Jennifer?
Well, the two most common things that you would see in a game would be the use of food products. For example, you could see floating bits of cereal or candy floating across the screen, or they could be used you know, they're fully integrated into the game so that, for example, you might have to go chasing after and capture bits of candy, and the more candy you accumulate, you know, you get points. Or the same thing would be with cereal. Or the logos were very prominent for the different foods as well, either fully integrated into the game, so as part of the game, you're looking at the game and you would see, you know, the logos.
Yes. Diana Cassidy, are AdverGames as regulated as commercials are on TV?
No, they're not. And that was one of the inspirations of this research, to kind of bring this to light to the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and also to parents. You know, there are a lot of parents that are busy and don't always know even what their young children are doing on the computer. And this AdverGame phenomena really does require public discussion.
What specifically do you think could or even should be done about advergames?
Well, I think that's something, you know, we need to talk about as parents, as food industry representatives. But, you know, the reality is we're in the middle of a terrible health crisis. This generation of children might be the very first to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. And everybody needs to do their part. You know, I'm a parent, and I monitored what my children did on the internet when they were younger. The food industry also needs to play their part. They've promised to limit food advertising to children. They haven't made those kinds of promises with advergames, and I think it's now, unfortunately, sort of a covert or stealth operation that really deserves a lot more attention.
I see. Jennifer Culp, do you remember when you were doing the research seeing any advergames that you felt sent positive messages or helpful messages about food or health?
Well, there were no advergames that advertised what we, you know, would call healthy food like fruits and vegetables. There were a few companies that would have you know, in between a game, there would be a pop-up message, and it might say something like, you know, get up and walk around or do some kind of physical activity. And a few sites also had links to, you know, nutrition sites like mypyramid.gov. However, those links were way down at the bottom of the page, and it's not likely that you would see them unless you scrolled all the way down to the bottom of the page.
Did you get the impression those were sort of token additions?
Well, that was my impression. And, you know, it's the food company's way of responding to criticism about advertising unhealthy foods to children.
Yes. Well, thank you both so much. We've been talking about advergames. This is online entertainment used to promote products to children. Oftentimes, kids are sent to the advergames through websites promoted on commercials on TV. The researchers at UC Davis I just talked with, Diana Cassidy, Associate Professor of Public Health Sciences, and Jennifer Culp, Training Coordinator with the Food Stamp Nutrition Education Program. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, 32 singers, 32 songs, a double CD featuring Central Valley musicians. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight streams live at capradio.org/insight. Monday at this time, a program about the New York borough of Brooklyn. How did it become one of the world's most culturally and ethnically diverse places? Insight returns on Tuesday. Topics include the uncertain future of the Auburn State Recreation Area now that the federal government says it's pulling its funding. There is an ambitious new music and photography project out of Modesto. It's called Portraits, 32 Singers, 32 Songs. It's a compilation double CD of music by varied artists, many of whom live in or around Modesto or have ties to the area. Along with the songs are photo portraits of the musicians. Joining us are the person who put it all together, the project's photographer, and two of the musicians you can hear on the CDs. We'll start with Greg Edwards, who's a music promoter in Modesto. And he's the guy who put Portraits, 32 Singers, 32 Songs together. Greg, welcome.
Hi. How are you doing?
What gave you the idea for such a big project? Because this is very different from booking a band or two at a venue.
Right. The size of the project really didn't factor into my initial idea of putting the project together. It just kind of became as big as it is through just starting to put everything together.
So did it start off with fewer than 32 singers?
Well, I just started inviting people, and it just started adding up to 32 people. And I thought, you know, I'm going to put out a single disc. And then I was like, wait, how much time actually fits on a single disc? I actually need to make a double disc compilation now because I've already asked too many people. Well, not too many, 32 people. It's a good, nice round number.
And what was the starting point for you? What was the concept behind it? What did you want to achieve?
Sure, sure. I really wanted to put out a compilation to showcase what I felt was the best talent in the Central Valley and the actually Northern California of people doing music right now. I really wanted to inspire people who are a part of the project and people who were listening to the project and seeing what's going on to view the place where they live in a positive way. And not focus so much on the negative stuff that happens around the area. And I also wanted to strengthen the community of artists that make up the off-the-air music scene in Modesto.
Off-the-air being your music promotion company.
Yes, yes. And I wanted them to, through, you know, all together being on this project, to hopefully build stronger relationships to where they would want to network and work together and hopefully create more projects would come out of this, really just to inspire people to do more with their art and music.
Well, I would imagine it was quite a big deal just to pull together the music, 32
right.
tracks from 32 artists, but there's a photographic component. We'll talk with the photographer in a moment, but why did you decide to make photographs a key part of the portraits project?
Right. I thought putting out just a regular compilation would be a good thing, but I wanted something that would demand a little bit more attention because in Modesto, a lot of what you hear about are negative things, and I really wanted to push something more positive out. So I thought I wanted to have the project have depth. So I thought a really cool thing to be would be to invite a photographer on board to photograph all 32 songwriters, and then we would then take those photographs, mat and frame them, and create an art show with those photographs. And so we would have a CD release art show, and it would be something that's in everybody's yeah. face a little bit and stuff. So and they would have to take notice.
Well, the photographer is with us, Doug Hokum. Doug, welcome.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Do you do this kind of work a lot, musicians?
No, well, you know, about 6 months ago, I started photographing Greg's off-the-air productions, the bands and everything, and so I think, you know, he saw me. We really haven't been friends that long, and so no, I don't. And it's the first time I've actually set out to photograph musicians that weren't actually on stage.
How did you set about doing this, because you want it all to hold together as a project, not just random photographs mm-hmm, mm-hmm. of 32 different people, and also to be a component of a bigger project. How did you set about deciding what these photographs were going to look like?
Well, you know, it took two things that kind of made that somewhat complex is that we also wanted to photograph the artist in a comfortable place, either their home, their studio, wherever they're comfortable. And so that added that component, not having that direct control of a studio. What we decided is to go black and white. With black and white, whatever they're wearing, wherever you're at, you have a little bit more control over the tones. And so that, we went black and white, and it really worked well.
We're talking about Portraits, 32 singers, 32 songs. It's a double disc compilation CD with an accompanying art show of photographs portraying the artists. The artists are all from Northern California, many from or the Modesto area or that general area or have ties to the area. There's a release show and art reception tomorrow night at the Urban Hive in Midtown Sacramento. And Greg Edwards, who put it together, is in our studio. Doug Hokum, the photographer. Let's listen to one of the tracks from the CD. This is by the band Not an Airplane, and the song is Trains.
Starting tonight, I have started to hate life, the places it takes me while I wait to die. And I'm trying to think, trying to think, trying to think about it. Well, I may be away and you may be alone. Things won't stay this way, I say into phones while day after day.
The song is called Trains by the band Not an Airplane, who, by the way, by coincidence, will be on Insight next Friday. Greg Edwards, how did you decide who all the artists would be? 32 artists. Did you have some big master sheet, or was it whoever wanted to do it?
I just started putting a list together when I was at work one day, and it was everybody that's on the compilation has played an off-the-air show before, and you know the people who are on the compilation are just a sampling of the many artists that we've had a chance to work with. So I just... those were just the artists that were at the top of my mind, and who knows in the future.
Track 8 on disc 1 is Boy Scouts, and Boy Scouts is in our studio. And Boy Scouts really is Taylor Vick. Taylor, welcome.
Hi.
You're not a Boy Scout?
No, I'm not.
Where does the name Boy Scouts come from? You're a woman and you're single. You're one person, rather.
It kind of just came to me one day, sort of. I kind of took it as a joke. I wasn't too serious about the name, and it just stuck.
Yeah. And you're here today with someone who often plays with you, Scott Huerta. Scott,
yes.
Welcome.
Hello.
What's your contribution to Boy Scouts?
I've been friends with Taylor for a long time, and she has really cool ideas with her songs, and sometimes she just doesn't have enough hands to do it. So that's where I come in, and I just kind of fill in the spaces.
The rest of the time you play with an indie rock band.
Yes.
Doing what?
I sing.
And the group's called the French Cassettes.
French Cassettes.
That's a funny name.
Is it kind of silly?
Yeah. No, I didn't say it was silly. It's just a funny name.
Oh, man.
Taylor, tell us about Boy Scouts. We're going to hear one of your songs, but just tell us about what you do musically.
Well, I've been playing music for a long time, and I used to just go under my name, Taylor Vick, but I didn't want to be so upfront. So I guess that's a better answer for where Boy Scouts came from. And it's just a collection of songs that I've made up over the years. And it's just something fun to do. Keeps me busy.
Well, let's hear one of your songs. It's actually the song that's on the 32 Singer 32 Song CD, but this is you playing in our studio with Scott Huerta. What's the song called?
It's called Take Yours.
Okay, let's hear it. Very nice. The song Take Yours, performed in our studio by Boy Scouts, which is Taylor Vick, ably assisted by Scott Huerta on percussion. Taylor, are you going to be at this event tomorrow night at the Urban Hive, the 32 Singers, 32 Songs?
Yes, I will be attending.
Yeah, and you're going to be playing?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Scott, are you going to be there too?
I will be there as well.
And also your band, your other band, French Cassettes, are they going to play?
No, it's just I just take one for the team and I do it myself.
Greg Edwards, how many artists are going to be there tomorrow night?
23 out of the 32 songwriters are going to be at the show performing their song from the compilation.
Wow, so even if no one went, the place is going to be busy.
Right,
And Doug, your photographs are going to be displayed too.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. It's a great venue, great town, new town, so I'm looking forward to it.
So 32 photographs of musicians, but there are a few other photographs, including yours truly.
Yeah. Greg and I, we got together. It was a great night and took each other's picture. Yeah. And it was really, he went down to the basement, came up with these glasses and stuck them on me. And it's a great photo.
Well, good. Well, thanks so much. Good luck with it all. And we've been talking about Portraits, 32 singers, 32 songs. It's a compilation double CD of a wide variety of musicians, many in or around or with ties to the Modesto area. Greg Edwards is a music promoter in Modesto with a company named Off the Air. He put this together. The accompanying photographs and art show put together by Doug Hokum, and in our studio, Taylor Vick, who is Boy Scouts, along with Scott Huerta. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus celebrates turning 25. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Listen to Insight when you like. Find our podcast at capradio.org/insight. Today on Capital Public Radio News, one of the Sacramento region's busier bridges shuts down tonight for the weekend to allow for construction. The Hazel Avenue Bridge is scheduled to reopen on Monday morning. Also, the European debt crisis could cause problems for U.S. exporters, including many in the Sacramento region. Those stories and more on All Things Considered. The Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus has turned 25. The concerts this year celebrate that anniversary, culminating in a unity concert this weekend. Several other Sacramento music groups are also on the bill. Three key members of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus join us. We'll start with Mike Tentis, who's chairman of the board of directors. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You've been with the chorus for quite a long time, not the whole 25 years, but close to it.
Almost. Started in 1988.
Are there any members today of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus who've been there since the beginning?
Yes, there are. We have several members who are founding members who still sing with us. One, indeed, has sung every show for 25 years.
My goodness. Do you get the sense that the founding members are surprised that the group is still around? I mean, 25 years is a long time for any performing arts group.
For any nonprofit performing arts group, the challenges that we face with raising money and staying a going concern never seem to end. But we're grateful to a number of our founding members for sticking through and still being here.
Paul Jones is also with us, artistic director of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus. Paul, how long have you been with the group?
Actually, I've been with the group since 1989 is when I started as a singing member.
I see. And how do you become artistic director?
How do you become artistic director? You are happily led towards it. Actually, I was asked to be the artistic director after our late director emeritus, Carl Nalawai Jr., decided that he was, you know, wanted to do something else. So I was the assistant director at the time. So I was given that opportunity to take that the leadership role as the artistic director in 2005.
And you have a pretty extensive experience in musical theater.
I've done musical theater. I've done shows at Woodland Opera House when I took my hiatus from the chorus. So I always like to keep doing stuff like that. But I was also a musician, even, you know, growing up through school, in band, chorus, and then when I left, when I joined the military, I was also in the Army chorus. So,
I see. And Chris Huber, also with us, is president of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
How long have you been with the group?
I started the group in 2006.
And as president, what do you do?
Well, I'm kind of responsible for helping to make sure that the rehearsals are run pretty smoothly, and that when the shows happen and are performed, that we have everything in place that needs to be in place, and with our show coming up tomorrow night, there's a lot of factors that go into that. So luckily, I have a very good comparable team on behind me that can help make sure everything gets done.
Yeah, we're talking about the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus celebrating its 25th anniversary. There's a concert this Saturday night in Midtown Sacramento. Let's listen to a clip of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus singing. This is actually from just last month, recorded in May at the Crest Theater in Sacramento at an event honoring Harvey Milk. And this is Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Somewhere Over the Rainbow, recorded live at the Crest Theatre last month by the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus. Well, actually, just part of the chorus. Mike Tentis, roughly how many people were singing there, and how many people are actually in the whole chorus?
Well, that depends on the show, Jeffrey. We start the season strong, and we had 42 people on stage for our spring Broadway show, and at the Crest last month, we had about 25.
I see. Well, it's still a good number of people. Now, The Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus, I've also seen it referred to as the Sacramento Men's Chorus. For example, on your 2000 CD Mosaic, it's the Sacramento Men's Chorus. Paul Jones,
yes.
Which is it?
It's the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus.
Okay, so why is it sometimes, or was sometimes, the Sacramento Men's Chorus?
You know, when we way back in the 80s, I think people were not as comfortable with the term gay, and for a lot of people, and even myself included, I was not comfortable in being out. So I think that kind of reflected the group itself. So after 20 some odd years, we're not the same organization that we were, and so it just felt right that that at this time that we should be coming out. So,
Chris Huber, do you think this in part reflects an evolution in Sacramento, that Sacramento as a whole is more comfortable with the notion of a gay men's chorus as opposed to a men's chorus?
I definitely do. Even since I've been involved with the organization, I've seen a tremendous amount of bigger support from the community, more the straight community, and we're really getting approached more recently too with different events, people wanting us to come and perform for them, and also with different churches around town, they're actually interested in having us come and rehearse in their spaces. So it's been a nice outreach.
Mike Tentis, you've been with the group for a long time. How have you seen the chorus's position and acceptance and importance in the community change?
When we first started, the chorus was not a shadow organization, but it was a decidedly singing, preaching to the choir, singing to the choir, i.e. singing to the gay community primarily. Our primary audience demographic today is comprised of a broad spectrum of the greater community, and we work hard to do outreach to, we've done a number of fundraisers for, we're doing one for cottage housing coming up here at the end of the month. So we do a great deal of community outreach and try to support the community that supports us.
And for people who are not familiar with cottage housing, that's a transitional housing program for homeless or formerly homeless people, including Quinn Cottages, which we actually talked about yesterday with Bishop Francis Quinn. Let's listen to another clip of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus singing. This is from that CD that I referred to called Mosaic, and it's a song that the group is long associated with. It's The Rhythm of Life.
Oh,
Well, in fact, that song is not Rhythm of Life. It's another famous song, Family. It is still from that CD Mosaic that I referred to. Mike Tentis, how do you choose the songs you're going to sing?
We have quite a little process for doing that. For instance, for the upcoming cottage housing event, they asked us to sing some uplifting music. So we have a deep archive of music that we can go through, and it's organized thematically. And the Gay and Lesbian Alliance of Choruses provides a great deal of help with programming. A wide variety of sources.
Paul Jones, as artistic director, anything to add to that?
Actually, one of the things that I personally have always tried to involve is the chorus members in the decision of the music choices. So we actually have a music advisory committee that meets to help flesh out the themes of our concerts, as well as to provide input on song choices and such. And then I just like to have final say and final vetoes.
Paul, if I may, you said earlier that there was a time when you were not comfortable being out. Did that coincide with your service in the U.S. Army?
It was after that, actually. So, I mean, it was having to lead that double life was a very difficult thing. So when I got out of the service, I that's pretty much when I decided to come out. And coming into the Sacramento Men's Chorus at the time was one of those things that that helped me in being comfortable with myself. It was very much a family atmosphere, and everyone there I counted as my very close friends. So
I guess the process that's going on in Washington that appears to be leading to ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell has a particular resonance for you.
It does, actually. And I was in the military even before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So being able to see that act may be abolished is a wonderful thing, and it's something I believe that we should be able to serve freely.
The Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus, celebrating its 25th anniversary. They are in a concert called Unity this Saturday evening at 8 at First United Methodist Church in Midtown Sacramento. It's 2100J. They're one of several groups performing that evening. And our guests were Paul Jones, who you just heard, Artistic Director of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus, Mike Tentis, Chairman of the Board of the Chorus, and Chris Huber, President of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight's theme was written by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Mara Ponce, Esteban Hernandez, and Jamie Crowell. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. And the executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.